This is Frank Tanner, and you are lucky enough to be listening to Verbal Shenanigans.
But our shenanigans are cheeky and fun. Yeah, I mean, your shenanigans are cruel and tragic. Which makes them not shenanigans at all, really. Evil shenanigans.
I swear to God, I'll pistol whip the next guy that says shenanigans.
Right, hello and welcome on back to the Verbal Shenanigans extravaganza, if you will. Yes, it's different than your average week. It's not just an episode, Berlo, it's an extravaganza. That's our new motto here on the show.
It's an adventure in unbridled entertainment.
An audio adventure. But anyway, hello everybody. I am Scott there, and that is Mike, and we are, two parts of what you would call Verbal Shenanigans. We've been a podcast now for unbelievably over just about 5 years. Over 5 years at this point.
Look at that!
I know,
5 years and weekly, pretty much.
Yeah, 5 years and when we first started, it was a little bit more random, but we were still cranking them out, even when we were, you know, first starting, kind of figuring out. We've come a long way, Berlo, since you lying on my couch with the toilet paper roll and the microphone stuck in it. And first started, we also tried to be like just like a comedy podcast, and that kind of we realized we weren't funny after a couple episodes. So
we talked to each other for a few weeks. We're like, no, this ain't working. We'll keep doing it, but this ain't working. Yeah.
We got to shift our focus here a little bit. we've been going for about 5 years, I would say. For at least 4 years, we've been going pretty strong with the format we've been in at this point. As far as if you're just tuning in, every week we bring on an interesting guest or two. Like in last week's case, we brought on Chris Lucas, who was the son of Ed Lucas, who was the blind announcer for the New York Yankees, had a book. He's also a Disney historian, blah, 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 blah. The guy's done a whole bunch of stuff. Go back and listen to last week's episode. Very interesting. And then in the same episode, we were joined by a band called Thumpasaurus, who is out of L.A., like an old punk funk band. Very interesting. And they had a rock opera involving John Travolta. just go listen to the interview because it probably makes no sense what I'm saying right now. And then we talked about bears. So it was a good episode. We 2 weeks be 2 weeks ago we had Stu Cook from Creedence Clearwater on. So it's we've been doing a lot of stuff here. I would say each week we've been trying to expand the podcast a little bit. You can find us in Pittsburgh, and you can find us in Washington State and Washington D.C. on internet radio. So we are, and we'll go through that info at the end. But that was my long go about of saying hi to everybody. Hi.
Yeah. Now, Scotty, as a callback to our guest from last week, Thumpasaurus,
yep.
Are they the best name band we ever had on the show? Now,
Good question. We've had a lot of musicians on. We were talking, I think, last week, and we think musicians probably the number one category we've had on. But as far as a name, Thumpasaurus, pretty solid name for a band, especially a funk band. Like right away, that kind of meshes together beautifully. We have had what's his name from President of the United States of America, which I don't know if that's a great name, but it's a name that you certainly remember. You can't quite forget
Chris
it.
Ballou.
Chris yep. Ballou, yeah. I don't know.
We had Steven Seagulls.
Oh yeah, that is true. We had the entire Steven Seagulls band on from Finland. That was quite an interview. That was five people at once trying to answer things. Plus, there was a little bit of a language barrier. So, but if you've never heard Steven Seagulls, I know this is like a promotion of an episode a long time ago. You got to go check their stuff out. Very amusing.
They do bluegrass, old school rock.
Yeah, like metal.
They do covers.
Yeah, covers. But I might put Thumpasaurus up there on the Verbal Shenanigans Mount Rushmore of band names we've had on, for sure.
Yeah, I mean, that sounds like a really weird thing to carve into a large mountain, but let's do it.
It also sounds like the worst title you could ever hold. Oh, I was number one on the Verbal Shenanigans Best Band Award. Who?
That's when you got arrested for DUI and you can't find a job, and that's the best thing you could put on your resume.
Right. Sir, we see there's a 13-year gap in your work history, and it says you're number one on the Verbal Shenanigans music list? What the hell is this?
Yeah, well, you know, that's something I really hold near and dear to my heart. When they gave me the award, I was so affected by it. And I had to take some time to myself to really, you know, brighten in my universe, if you will, to just let it seep in the accomplishments I had. And I remember celebrating, and then there was a blackout, and then there was a court day. But still, you have to focus on the number one name of Verbal Shenanigans.
I like Lucky Chops. That was a cool name for a band that we had on.
That's not a bad one right there.
But let's do
an entire episode on this conversation, Scott.
I like Iron Maiden. Did you know an Iron Maiden was an old torture device? No, I didn't know that, Scott. Like, let's look into it.
We love you, audience. You all sound like that, but we love you.
Berlo, I'm getting married, and when this episode comes out, less than 2 weeks.
I know, man. It's exciting, man.
It is. It is. It's exciting. It's frightening. It's funny. Looking back on things like, you know, how this all started, and I mean, you were around for the entire rise and fall of Scott Brennan, if you will, or I guess I should say fall and rise. You know, from times when we were back at my own house, we moved the podcast to my parents' house for a little while. Then we moved the podcast to my old place. Then you moved to Georgia. So we've been able to keep the glue together here. But yeah, getting married is kind of crazy. I was thinking of kind of the origins, like some of the early stories as far as my relationship with Alex. I don't think I ever told this on the podcast, but it's a pretty funny story, so I figured I'd bring it up. So when we were first dating, now I had gotten out of a brutal relationship. I basically had lived alone for quite a long time in a house and was trying to keep the bills afloat. I went through a divorce and all that stuff, and wasn't really dating for a while, but was still technically, I guess, married, if you will, waiting for the process. At one point, I was deciding whether to do it by myself or get a lawyer, and financially, all that stuff, blah, 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 blah. So it took a long time. So the marriage was completely over. Had gone on a couple weirdo dates with with people. I know there's a – I guess I never told this either on the podcast, but it's in my act. I went on this date where this girl had told me to meet her at her house. I was like, okay, meet her at the house. And she's like, she's like a normal-looking person. I'm like, not bad. And when I walked into her house, like above her TV was a shelf like full of all these colorful skulls.
Yeah, I remember this from the bit.
Yeah, yeah.
I'll let you continue. I don't want to spoil the joke.
Oh, no. I'm not even going to, like, do the punchlines and whatnot. But it's in my act. But she had these skulls. Like, she takes crayons and melts them on top of them. But, like, walking in, there's, like, you know, six or seven of them on a shelf. And the house is kind of dark. And there's a candle burning. And just totally not my vibe. She's like, oh, yeah, you know, that's my art. And I sell them online. I'm like, oh, okay, cool. So needless to say, that was like a one and done date at this point.
I wonder how you go about searching on the internet and eventually saying, I'm buying a yellow crayon skull.
Well, I don't know. She apparently took the crayons on her. Oh, I see what you mean. Like looking for her product. Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, like It's like, oh, I wonder how the Phillies did tonight. I wonder how stocks doing. Purple skulls. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, there's definitely a niche audience for that. But so I had only a couple weird dates. I was kind of to myself for a long time. But I met Alex, and long story short, I'm not going to tell you this like romance story. But so no one really knew we were dating for a while because, you know, I was still coming out of it and stuff like that. And you had known, but my parents had not known for a little while. And, you know, like she was staying over the house. And I remember me and my dad were working on the house to try to sell the house. So, you know, doing a lot of things, get it cleaned up, fixing some things that needed to be fixed. And now my father is he's like a workaholic. So like if you're doing something, he'll want to come up and help you, but he'll want to do it like every day straight. Like there's no downtime. He'll be like, oh, I'll be there tomorrow at, I'll be there at 7:30 a.m. And it's like, oh, Dad, you know, like, can I sleep in? Can we finish the rest next weekend? You know, like, which is a good and bad thing, you know, which is a blessing and a curse at the time, at the moment.
Fertilizing can't wait for anybody, son.
So I remember one time Alex had stayed over, and I was just like, oh, my dad will probably be here like 10, 11. Sure enough, like, he gets there about like 7 a.m. or something like that. Something ridiculous, 7:30. I'm like, oh, my God. Like, oh, my God. And it's not even like my dad would care, but I was like, oh, you got to get out. Like, oh, my God. So, like, I remember now my old driveway was very steep. Like, so the car would have to come down the driveway. So I remember I devised this plan because I said, Alex, you got to get out of here, blah, blah, blah. So she went out my back door in my backyard with her clothes in her hand and, like, heels on from the night before. And I devised this plan. And her car was, like, up on the street. So he had to pass right past her car, come in the driveway. Mm-hmm. So I devised this plan that if I walk out and I stand in front of the passenger side window and like knock on the door and say something stupid like, hey, you're here early, and try to play like defense.
Dad, look at me, Dad.
So he's looking at me, you know, and she goes around the back with her clothes in hand and runs through the neighbor's lawn to hop in the car. And long and short, she was able to escape without my father seeing her. But it's amazing to me. The reason I'm bringing this up is, one, obviously the wedding's coming and it's just a funny story. But two, it's amazing to me that even when you're in your mid-30s, you know, you've been through a marriage and a divorce and house buying and grown up and you've been an adult for a long time, that you still have that kid part in you, that I don't want my dad to find out kind of thing. That, you know what I mean? Like, do you have that, like, still feeling deep in you somewhere? Like, oh, I'm still my parents' child. You know what I mean?
Well, yeah, I mean, I still have that thing where it's like I pretty much look up to him, and it's like if I do something stupid, it's like, oh man, I don't want to tell my dad. I don't want to hear the lecture and all. Yes, Dad, I should have checked the the batteries on the fire alarms. I'm sorry, Dad. Yes, I know it's supposed to be every 6 months. I'm sorry.
Why is it that every dad is so much smarter than the kid? Yeah, like, if I have kids, are my kids just going to be insanely dumb? Because, like, I have a pretty low feeling of how smart I am at this point. I've talked about this on the podcast. Like, I feel dumber than ever these days. Like, I feel like I used to be kind of a smart person. Not anymore.
Well, I think where it boils down to is in our dad's times, it's like you had to learn it. You had to. If you wanted a career, college wasn't like a thing then. It's like they get trained on this, and there's nobody around usually to help them with the houses, so they go through the fires and everything like that to figure it out. Whereas ours, it's just like, oh, I'll Google it.
Right.
And usually when we Google it, it's like after we basically destroyed half our property of some sorts.
Right. Yeah, it's just funny. It's like it's kind of you know, with the wedding coming up and when this episode comes out in a week or whatever, it's very, very interesting, like, how, you know, that old saying, like, time flies by. But it is amazing to think that, like, a whole chunk You know, we've been together 4 years now, which is it's crazy to think about. And you know, people ask me like, "Oh, you're doing it again. You're having another kind of a big wedding, fancy wedding." And like, the reason I wanted to have another kind of like full wedding is I didn't want my memories, because my fiance, wife in a week, whatever you want to call her, my fiance in a week, she's never been married before, so I didn't want my memories like of having a big nice wedding, a fancy wedding, to be of only having it with someone who didn't deserve it. My ex, like, who was a, you know, turned out to be a beast, did a lot of terrible things to me, and like her getting this second best, like this adjustment, you know what I mean? Like, oh, we'll just do it at the we'll do it at the VFW hall or something. Like, I wanted her to have what she wanted too. So that's kind of my reasoning behind doing, you know, the whole thing. But God, planning a wedding is crazy, I will tell you that.
Now, I got to ask you, as much as I see everything you're saying here, but was there one thing that, like, she brought up where you're almost like, oh, I want to give you what you want, but ooh, the swans in the lake? No, honey. No.
I gotta give her the credit. Like, nothing we're doing is over the top, if you will. She, you know, at one point I had to talk her down a little bit on like how crazy to go with the flowers and stuff like that. But I gotta give the girl credit. She has not gone bridezilla or like needs this and this, because essentially we're paying it for herself. We have a little help from my parents, but essentially we are funding the whole operation. And let me tell you, Mike, being a podcaster and a comic is not the most lucrative of businesses. So we do have to work the old day jobs, which are also not the most lucrative of businesses. So I know you guys listening out there are like, they must make millions. Like, this should be nothing. But no.
So you're saying you had to get the used horse-drawn carriage to bring in your wife?
Right. We just settled for the carriage without the horses. I have a couple big – I got a couple big friends that, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. Instead of blue angels coming by, you had to get the lesser-known brown angels to do a flyby. Yeah.
Well, you kind of had the opposite. You got married last year. And your wife had been married before, and you hadn't. But, you know, it's like a little different when it comes from the guy's perspective.
Yeah, I mean, it worked out in the sense we both kind of had the same goal of keeping it small, right, keeping it with the family, not making a big deal. I mean, she kind of had a similar scenario where her marriage ended not on the greatest ways that she wanted to, for obvious reasons, so she wanted nothing to do with the whole fancy wedding and halls and stuff like that. I mean, you know me, I'm a pretty laid back kind of, I don't need a huge spotlight kind of guy when it comes to personal things. So it kind of just worked out where we said, hey, we just bought this nice house. We can get people to come over here. We had some local friends, we had family came down, and kept it as simple as humanly possible. And I mean, it was still beautiful. We put money into a photographer. She got a nice wedding dress that she found. You know, all in all, we kept it on the cheap, but we kept everybody kind of relaxed and not had to worry about putting on a crazy suit or anything like that. And after the ceremony was over, we were out there in t-shirts and shorts and all, just dealing up with the family.
Define crazy suit.
Crazy suit? you know, like with belt buckles and
big
collars, big hats, and you know, a monocle and those glasses that they use at the theaters to look at, you know, the one that's at the end of a stick.
So that was the original vibe you were going to go for, but you decided.
I said, babe, I want to say I do as the Monopoly man.
Right.
And she had nothing to do with it. it was a big fight, but eventually we said I do.
Yes. So maybe by the next episode, I will be I'll be married again. I'll be remarried and not remarried. So married again. Well, I don't know. I guess remarried. Whatever. But yeah. So by whenever the next episode or the episode after, I don't know. But it's pretty. Pretty crazy. Time does really, 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 really fly pretty quickly. But But Berlo, I'm very excited about our guest today. I got to sit down with him about a week ago, and I've been following his music for a while. I saw him about, I don't know, it had to be like 8 years ago with Modest Mouse up at Omegang Brewery. Been following him for a long time, and his music, really enjoy his music, has a big following. He's actually coming to Jersey in a few weeks. But I got to sit down with the one and only Frank Turner. Now, Frank Turner... Ooh. Has been making music for quite a while. He used to be in a metal band. Now he's becoming pretty prolific. He has, like, I don't know, 7 or 8 albums. We really had a really, really good interview where he covered a lot of his music. His book that's coming out, we talked about him. He got to open the Olympic Games a couple years ago. Just a lot of cool stuff in this interview. One of my favorite interviews of the year, if not in totality of the podcast, one of my favorite interviews. So you guys might know him, Frank Turner. Here is our interview, and without further ado, let's do it. Hey, Frank Turner.
Hello, how you doing?
I'm doing great. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. Yes, just at home in London town.
Ah, yes, I am I am home in the beautiful state of New Jersey at the moment. But
lovely.
Frank, first off, I want to thank you for sitting down with me for a couple minutes. I really appreciate the the amount of time you're able to give us. I'm sure you're quite busy at the moment.
I'm at home, which is quite nice. I'm quite busy with various different projects, but today I'll be honest with you. Today I'm having a hangover day. It's a friend of mine.
Well, you know, we've all been there. I had that day yesterday. So,
There you go.
I guess you're coming off the heels of your 7th studio album. You got a whole bunch of EPs. You just wrote another book. You're starting to accumulate a good amount of not only songs and writing. You're becoming a pretty prolific writer. I guess I want to start. What is your writing process? Are you like a guy? Are you a pen to paper kind of guy? Like just writing it all out constantly, or you just get like spurts of creativity? How do you go about writing? And now you're, like I said, you've got a lot of stuff at this point.
Yeah. Well, I mean, generally speaking, to be mechanistic about it, I tend to, like, for me, writing songs is a multi-stage process, and there's the kind of, there's the much idealized initial idea moment, like, get in mad, you know, but exciting. And I write, you know, if it's a melodic or a guitar idea, I'll make a voice note on my phone or whatever, and I have an arcane system of notebooks in which I write stuff down. But then, you know, that's not writing a song right there. That's just kind of getting the ingredients together. Right. For that, I spend a lot of time kind of sorting through stuff, you know, and actually doing the hard craft work, you know, of putting a song together. And then, you know, and then there's arrangement and there's recording and there's just a million other aspects to it. And I mean, it changes over time and it's always slightly different with every song and there's no rhyme or reason to it. And as I get older and I have more material under my belt and I'm trying not to repeat myself, you know, I think that the process changes over time in a good way. Writing a book, on the other hand, is just nightmarishly hard for me, but I've done it.
Right.
That's literally just a case of forcing myself to write. I just kind of set aside like a couple of hours every day and give myself, you know, a word count to hit, whatever it might be.
Okay. So like, I guess the most recent thing that came out was the book. Can you tell us like a little bit? I know it. I haven't had a chance to read it yet, but I know it focuses on different, you know, your different songs and how you wrote them. So what do people should they expect from reading the book?
Well, so the first book that I did, which was about 4 years ago, was a book about touring and a collection of my tour stories, and it went sort of surprisingly well, like. You know, people bought it and read it and enjoyed it and all this kind of shit.
Right.
and the publishers were keen to do another one. I didn't really see the point in writing a sequel. I felt like I'd said what I needed to say about touring. So, and it occurred to me that in writing about nearly 1,500 shows in that book, I hadn't ever really mentioned the songs I was playing while I was playing all of these shows.
Right.
And that struck me as something that would be worth talking about. And the other thing is that I think about songwriting pretty much to the exclusion of all else. And in the past, I haven't really talked about it much. And I realized at a certain point that that was laziness more than anything else on my part, because it's quite difficult to find the vocabulary to discuss it properly. But it is doable. You just have to knuckle down and think about it properly. So that's what I did. But yeah, so it's not quite a manual, but it's a discussion, a long form discussion of songwriting with a degree of kind of memoirization in there as well.
Now, when you sit down and actually analyze your writing process through actually writing the book, does that help you get motivated to write songs again? Like, does it almost help you rediscover, like, because now you're looking at it almost from a, you know, an outside perspective on your own songs. Does it help you kind of like, oh, hey, like that is how I wrote that, or you're almost missing something in your own songs?
Well, I mean, I've sort of been joking to people and saying I've now written two books, neither of which required any actual research because they're both about me. But that's not actually strictly true, simply because with this book, I actually went back and like listened to everything, you know, and like listened to every song. And then when I picked the songs I was going to write about, I listened to every demo version I have of it, you know, different live arrangements and all the rest of it. And it was an interesting process in terms of kind of surveying my catalog, if you like.
Right.
The main thing that it brought out for me was, because as I say, like not repeating myself is really important to me. And in going through it, I was able to identify quite a lot of common themes in my songwriting, which I immediately now I'm trying to jettison. Do you know what I mean? It's just kind of like, cool.
Right.
That's doing a lot. So stop doing that and do something different. You know what I mean?
Right.
Which I think is a healthy thing going forward.
Well, I got to say one thing that I've always liked about your writing. And, you know, I'm a comic also, so I kind of put it in a comedy perspective. You're very, especially over time, I feel like even though your songs, you know, are melodic, and stuff, you are very able to kind of open yourself up, your warts and all, you know what I mean? Like, and it's kind of that brutal honesty, and I think that's what really comes through for me. I don't know about all fans, but I think that's what I enjoy about you. If you look at it from a comics point of view, you know, like we're always looking for comics who are more honest, you know, like completely revealing themselves. And I think you have a little bit of that in your music.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think partly that more than anything else, that's just a question of taste. I mean, the songwriting that I have loved ever since I first kind of got into music is honest songs. And I love it when somebody says something in a song that feels unretractable.
Right.
Do you know what I mean? It's just like, holy shit, he just fucking said that, you know?
Yeah.
Like in particular, there's a writer called Aidan Moffat, who was in a Scottish band called Arab Strap.
Okay.
Who has his lyrics. It really feels like a man stabbing himself in the heart with a scalpel in front of you, but also with a sense of self-deprecation as well. And you know, I just enjoy that in the music that I write myself. I also, you know, I mean, there is a degree to which my various people have commented over the years that my songwriting is kind of a form of public therapy, and there's mileage in that statement. You know, I definitely work out shit in my own head,
right,
through the medium kind of discussing it in song, and I think that's a valid point.
Yeah, I mean, even when you say what you just said, you know, it kind of reminds me of like a Shane McGowan in a way, or someone like that who, you know, leaves it all out on the table. You know, alcohol problems, relationship problems, whatever it happens
to be.
Now, Be More Kind has been out for, we're coming up on close to a year. And I definitely, like you said, you try to change things up and jettison yourself from different sounds. I think you found a sound in that album that you definitely, I don't think, touched on you. A little bit of a softer sound, a lot more different harmonies and melodies. I'm noticing, I noticed a lot more, maybe some themes about, like, you know, how you treat other people. I mean, I don't know if I'm on with that, but I'm definitely seeing more, another change in you. This album seemed a lot different than the prior two. So
there was a very self-conscious attempt to kind of push myself out of my comfort zone on this record and on all angles. I mean, the previous record, Positive Songs, was an attempt at kind of like restatement of principle in a way. Do you know what I mean? It was like, go back to basics.
Right.
What do I do? What do I have to say? And I did that, and that was a success. And therefore, it was like, well, with the next thing I need to do, I want to go off preservation. And there were some important like methodological differences. For the first time, I had both the ability and the inclination to use the studio as an instrument and as a tool. And I went in with the songs written, but the arrangements really weren't written when we went in, and we did a lot of experimentation and messing around in the studio, which I've never really done before.
Right.
Often for financial reasons. Do you know what I mean? It's like you've got 10 days, make the record. So this time around we had a lot more time, and it was really, really interesting and fun getting into that. And it ended up messing around with a lot more kind of like electronic textures and that kind of thing, which has always been part of my taste, but it's not something I've tried to put in my music before. So that was fun. And then, lyrically, this is kind of the first record possibly ever, and certainly in a while, in which I've like felt like I had like something to say about the state of the world.
Yes.
You know what I mean? If that's not too gigantically pretentious a thing to say.
Well,
but,
like a song like 1933, that comes pretty, you know, pretty clear that, you know, you're saying everything's going back to, you know, World War II and prior. Kind of feels again.
Well, importantly, prior. I mean, the song is called 1933. It's not called 1939.
Right.
Or
right.
I feel very strongly that, like, if there are parallels between now and that period of history, and there are some, and there's probably less than some people think there are,
right,
but there are some. But the point is that there were other choices that could have been made, other decisions that could have been made in between 1933 and 1939. So let's make the choices differently this time around.
Yeah. I mean, and you've always been pretty open with her. I don't even know if you call it politically, but as far as your views and your strength. Now, I know like a while back you had, I was reading an article about you receiving death threats for saying this, that, and like, it feels like people allow you to change it, your art and your songwriting and whatnot. But if you say anything publicly in an interview, or I believe it seems like these days they don't want you to ever change or adapt or learn or grow. And it seems like you got crucified for almost nothing.
Yeah, that wasn't fun. I'll tell you that. And it was, I mean, the thing is, in discussing that whole thing, like, I mean, first of all, I have to take my share of the blame for it because, I made my point quite badly in what I was trying to say.
Right.
Like, and also, I can't spend my whole life running around trying to tell everybody who I am and then complain when not everybody thinks I'm great. Do you know what I mean?
Right.
Both of these are fair points. But there was an awful lot of straw manning going on and an awful lot of apostasy as well. There's a lot of people who made assumptions about me and what I might believe without ever having asked. And then when discovering what I actually think about the world, they were horrified to discover it wasn't what they'd lately assumed it was. And that apparently makes me an asshole, which I find kind of challenging, if I'm honest with you. But I guess the thing is, like, that whole thing happened at an earlier point in social media. And certainly, first of all, I've been through it. I've grown up a bit and all the rest of it. But also, I think collectively, everybody's a bit more wise to how awful social media is as a forum for serious political discussion these days. And like every now and again, something else flares up on Twitter or whatever. I've stopped reading Twitter completely
now.
You know, and the way I think about it is like there's shit written about me on the walls of toilets in bars I don't go to. I don't let it bother me. Do you know what I mean?
Like, right.
I'm doing my very best to kind of ignore that kind of thing. And, you know, I try and be a thoughtful and considerate person. I try and sort of think through my actions and my beliefs and their impact on the world and everything else. But, like, I don't need to do that through the medium of thousands of anonymous idiots shouting at me.
I mean, I always say, I've said it on the show a million times before that I feel like you could take your most left friend and your most right friend or whatever, however you want to call that, and everybody seems to agree on 90% of things. It's all these like radicalized point of views or the one thing you say off color that gets the attention. But you know, almost everybody, all good people seem to generally have a center point that a lot of people agree on. It drives me crazy. Yeah. Like you said, social media, it's pretty much the worst place to put anything out there besides pictures of food your content. That's about it.
I think it's a huge shame because I think there's potential for good in social media. And there are things that I've done on social media, like doing kind of like secret shows for charities and that kind of thing, which can be really exciting. Do you know what I mean?
It's like, of course,
put it out on your Twitter first thing in the morning and you end up with 500 people in a room by sundown. That's for a good cause. That's an awesome thing to use it for. It's just that there's a real premium placed on kind of rage and hatred. And people I really feel very strongly that one of the most disastrous things happening in our culture right now is people confusing anger with wisdom. Do you know what I mean? Like the angriest person in the room, yeah, the smartest person in the room. In fact, quite the opposite. Do you know what I mean? Rage doesn't make you think straight. So Yeah, I think social media is doing terrible things to our political discourse. I don't quite know what to do about that other than try and avoid it myself.
I like that, replacing anger with wisdom. It's a, it makes perfect sense. I guess shifting gears, I wanted to ask you about, I guess it was 7 years now, I guess, but you you had the unique experience of doing the opening ceremony for the Olympics.
Yes.
Did you ever think, you know, coming from a, I don't know what you want to call, post-metal band back in the day to kind of becoming this folky, punky, you know, song, just kind of writing honestly, that somehow along the way you get scooped up and be part of this, you know, this thing that's seen by 150-something countries around the world?
And, yeah, you know? The short answer to your question is no. I mean, the run-up to it was really weird because basically, so Danny Boyle, the director, was doing the opening ceremony, and this was public knowledge, and my manager got a call from his people asking us to go in for a meeting, and my manager and I discussed it and immediately said, well, it's not the Olympics, because it can't be the Olympics. That's ridiculous. So maybe he's working on a new film or something, or I don't know. And then we went down for a meeting, and he said, do you want to play the Olympic opening games? And I said, sure. I think that it's important to say yes as much as you can in life.
Of course.
Being the old guy propping up the bar telling the story about the time when I didn't play the Olympic opening ceremony is less interesting to me than if I will be able to do in a few years' time. So, you know, it was a very, very surreal experience. But it's cool. I think it was the moment when my mother accepted that I have a real job, which was
look, Mom, I'm on TV. Look at me.
Yeah, right. Yeah. But it was cool. I mean, I'm not particularly interested in like any kind of scale of values that has to do with like the honor of it or whatever. I'm not like in any way kind of a nationalist or anything. But it's cool. Do you know what I mean? I did that.
100%. It's cool. I mean, like you said, if you hadn't done that, I wouldn't ask you, like, tell me about the time you almost played.
That's a boring story.
Yeah. No, I just think it's really cool. Like, especially, you know, your music. I don't even know how to say this correctly. It's just under like mainstream. Like a lot of people in the punk rock and, you know, tours like that know of your music, and it's not on every radio station, but you know, people know your stuff, and it's pretty cool that they picked you up for such a thing that seems outside of that, you know?
Yeah, completely. It was very much just came down to Danny Boyle as a fan, the songs, I played three songs actually. They broadcast one of them, but I played three at the ceremony, and his choice of songs, because he said, I've got some suggestions. But he was like, you can play whatever you want, I've got suggestions. And I was like, dude, I'm going to go with your suggestions. Like, right. But, like, you know, one of the tracks that he picked was, like, a real deep-cut B-side. And it was just, like, you know, this is a man who knew his stuff, which was a real, really flattering thing.
Absolutely. Obviously your first book very much about the road and doing it now. I see not much has changed as far as your touring. I mean, I'm looking at your schedule right now, and it seems in about 3 weeks you're kind of off and running for a long a long time. You're coming here to Jersey and on May 12th.
Yes, indeed, which I'm very excited about.
Yeah, I mean, you're opening, I mean not opening, you're with a bunch of really cool bands throughout this tour, whether you're Dropkick Murphys fan, Against Me, whatever, you name it, you're with a bunch of cool people. But touring wise, how do you what kind of, at your age now, you know, you've been doing this a long time. Like I said, you got a plethora of music. How have things changed? Like, even since the book a couple years ago, as far as your touring, when you look at something like that, where you're going touring, your tour dates are up through November, as I'm looking. And it's a, you know, that's a daunting task for anyone, even though it's really awesome. How do you get in the mindset and the, you know, what kind of touring life do you live these days?
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's changed a lot since the early days. And one thing I would say is that we have actually slowed down appreciably in the last couple of years, partly because we're getting older and partly because now four members of my touring family have children, and you can't ask, you know, someone who's got a 6-month-old baby to fuck off and tour 6 months. You know what I mean? It's just doable. And like, I don't have kids, but like it's fun. Like, for a long time, I didn't really have any reason to go home. And now, you know, I'm getting married later this year. I have a house.
Congrats. Me too. I'm getting married in 3 weeks.
Congratulations to you.
Yeah, to you too.
But yeah, it's, you know, and so there's reasons to go home. And, you know, there's no shame in sort of admitting the obvious fact that there are things you can do in your early 20s that you can't do in your late 30s and beyond, in terms of your physical resilience and all that kind of thing.
For sure.
you know, and plus, I mean, you know, we did it. Do you know what I mean? I've done the years where I've done like nearly 300 shows and slept on the floor everywhere and played 24 shows in a row that day off. I did all that shit. And it's like, I don't, there was a period of time when I was definitely trying to prove something. And then it occurred to me that I could prove it. And, you know, I was engaged in a race in which no one else was taking part. And indeed, it wasn't doing me many favors in terms of my both physical and mental health. So we've chilled out a bit. I mean, the other thing is, you know, I don't sleep on the floor these days. I sleep in a tour bus or I get a hotel room, you know, and there is more comfort in my touring life now than there was, you know, 15 years ago or whatever, that, which is one of the wages of success, I suppose, which is a nice thing. But, you know, it's my job, touring. And right. I say that with pride and with happiness. You know, this is a thing I definitely know how to do and how to do it well. And I've been doing it my entire adult life. And I'm proud that I'm still doing it now.
Yeah, I mean, and if anybody, like, hasn't seen you live, I've seen twice. I remember my favorite time I saw you, you were opening for Modest Mouse at the Oma Gang Brewery in Cooperstown, New York. And
Cooperstown, New York, yeah, it was raining.
It was raining a little bit. It was just a really, really yeah. cool setting. It was a really cool show, too, the way it was, like, kind of set up. And But are you doing anything differently for these tours coming up in the new album as far as the band, or are you playing completely new set list? How do you build your set list with now, like I said, so much music?
Yeah, well, I mean, the first thing is like I spend too much of my life thinking about set lists. And if I could reclaim the amount of time I spend thinking about set lists and devote it to something constructive, that would be better for me. You know, I obviously the main difference is that there's new material to play, and we tend to, you know, have at least some focus on the most recent record when we tour. Although having said that, like I try hard to include material in the set every night from across my catalog. Do you know what I mean? I don't want to be one of those bands who doesn't play the old shit or whatever.
Yeah.
So there's that. I mean, it's the same band. It's the Sleeping Soul has been the same lineup for a long time now, over a decade, which is really cool. I'm really happy about that fact. You know, I mean, I don't want to repeat ourselves too much as we tour, but at the same time, it's like if I don't play Photosynthesis and I Still Believe, I tend to get murdered after the show. So, you know, there are sort of differing, conflicting imperatives there. But, you know, I want to try and change it up as I go. And I think about stagecraft an awful lot, you know, because that is a separate discipline to being a songwriter or a musician.
Yep.
Is how you put on your music and how you entertain and engage a crowd and all this kind of thing. And I think about that an awful lot as well. So I'm just trying to get better at it as I go by.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you, I mean, a lot of people know, like, I remember when you came out, everybody was like, wow, he was in this metal band before, and now he's in, and I'm like, nowadays, it doesn't seem that strange. Like, you know, people are into so many different kinds of music and are able to go from one thing to the other, but I don't know a lot about you, like, you're growing up with music. Were you, were you a guitar, like a classically trained kind of guy? Were you a, would you just pick up a guitar and have a garage band? What was your life like with music?
So my parents don't really listen to any modern music. And so I had this very kind of definite light switch moment when I was about 10 years old, where in the space of a couple of weeks, I encountered the music of Iron Maiden.
Nice.
Of all people. Yeah. I also watched the Freddie Mercury tribute concert live on the TV. That was kind of my first exposure to rock music in any shape or form. And it was, you know, it changed my life. The reverberations of that explosion are still with me now. And then, you know, I just got really, really, I mean, initially, I think I was a metalhead first, and then like punk rock took over my life, and hardcore particularly. And I played in hardcore bands and toured in hardcore bands. And I taught myself guitar and indeed how to sing and all this kind of thing. But yeah, I mean, just, you know, from that moment when I was about 10 years old, I sort of wanted to do music. I've never felt remotely as touched by anything else in all of human creation
right.
as I did by rock and roll music.
Now, what about your music now? Do you, I played bass for years, and I did everything by ear, and I kind of wish I, like, sat down and learned theory more and whatnot.
Yeah.
Are you strum chords on a guitar kind of guy, or do you actually, go note for note? What is your songwriting like?
Well, so I can't, like, read music notation, or okay. at least not not usefully. And the fact that I learned is, I mean, technically speaking, I'm a folk player rather than a classical player. Do you know what I mean? I sort of play by ear. I tend to think of chords in relation to each other rather than absolute terms. I actually had a really interesting moment a few years ago when I was jamming with some friends who are in a bluegrass band. And for the first time, somebody called out to, like, the music for the song we're about to do in the exact terms that I figured out on my own, in my own head. It was like, you know, Kappa 3 D shapes 1 5 6 4 or whatever, and I was like, I know what that means. As a guitar player, I'm trying to push myself forward as a go. The last couple of years, I've been really trying to learn bluegrass guitar properly.
Yep.
Which is a great discipline as a guitar player, incidentally, because there's a precision required for bluegrass which is really extreme. And if you can nail that, it will improve your playing across the board. So I've just been learning old trad Bill Monroe and, you know, Lester Flatt and Doc Watson tunes and all that kind of thing, which has been really fun. But I mean, I have some technical knowledge, and certainly, like, right, I've been doing this long enough that I have a reasonably broad understanding and analysis, certainly of the music that I can make. I've actually just finished making my 8th record, which will be out later this year.
Oh, wow. All right.
And in putting that together, it was quite a diverse record musically, and I found myself, like, conducting horn sections and string sections and quiet. Which was amazing. I mean, it was like, yes, I know what I want these people to play, and I know how to communicate with that to them, and that felt good.
So when can people expect to start hearing about the new album?
Pretty soon. I mean, we haven't mixed the record yet. We finished recording it. There's a podcast that's going to come with the record. And there's a whole bunch of, it's kind of a weird kind of concept album.
Awesome.
Many more parts of this will become clear very soon. But I think for the time being, let's just leave it vague.
All right. I don't want to bring it down a notch, but one thing I really kind of identify with you, and I really liked that you spoke up about it, was your work with Dying with Dignity. I think that's a tremendous issue that a lot of people are, you know, sometimes afraid to talk about, or it's taboo, or it does, everybody has an opinion on it, because we're all going to experience this someday, you know.
Sure.
Where did you start to become, or where and when did you really start to become involved in that and getting that message out?
The group got in touch with me. I think I met somebody at a show or whatever. I mean, it was an opinion I held anyway. You know, I feel very strongly, you've got dogs.
Yeah. He's like the third member of the podcast. He just doesn't shut up sometimes.
So. God, love it. What type of dog have you got?
He's a half English bulldog, half beagle. I'll have to show you. I'll have to show you him in a minute.
what's his name?
His name is Obi.
Obi. Very nice.
Obi. Yeah. He's basically, if you took a bulldog's body and pasted a beagle's head on it, that's what he looks like. Mm. But
wow, sounds interesting.
Yeah, I'll show you in a minute. I forgot that I didn't even have my camera on here. So
it's all good. The Dignity and Dialogue, yeah, I sort of encountered them at a show or something like that, but I feel very strongly that, like, in terms of personal autonomy, the most basic level of personal autonomy is that right to decide about your own life and about how it may or may not end. And I think the idea of sort of prohibiting people from taking that decision freely is bizarre to me. It seems like a huge, hugely authoritarian thing to do. I lend my name and my support to the campaigns that they have when I can. It's not something I spend a huge amount of my working on, but I'm very happy to be part of all of that.
Right. Yeah, I mean, it's like I said, it's something that doesn't get talked about often enough.
Sure.
But so I guess as we conclude here,
say about it, incidentally, is that, like, hopefully it's not a thing that many of us will actually need to.
True.
Be engaged with it on any kind of personal level. I sincerely hope that as few people as possible have to deal with that issue in their life. But when they do, I think that they should be free to make the decision that's right for them.
Right. So, I mean, as we conclude here, first off, Frank, I want to, I've been a fan of yours for a long time, so it's really cool to get down the to get down, to sit down and talk to you for a few minutes.
Yeah.
So I appreciate that. It's been a really cool week. Like last week, I got to talk to Stu Cook from Creedence Clearwater, who was really awesome, you know, and to get to talk to you in the same week, it's a very, you know, it's both sides of the music spectrum that I've kind of been listening to, both long.
Yeah, yeah.
But
Yeah,
I mean, I don't know a person who doesn't like Creedence. It's you know, it's almost impossible to not like something by them.
I have a friend of mine's grandmother. This is a true story. A friend of mine's grandmother, when she was kind of younger, got her neighbors evicted from the house down the street from her because they were practicing all hours of the day and she couldn't stand the noise. And it was Creedence Clearwater Revival.
Jeez. Yeah, I mean, you never know, right? I mean, it was just cool. We're talking about like the original Woodstock and when really cool to pick his brain for a while. But I guess before we go, obviously you got the new album you said soon, and I guess we'll find more stuff on that.
Yeah.
What other kinds of things are you working on? Is it just music, or do you have any other kind of projects going on? And what's the best place for people to check you out or see what's going on with you?
Yeah, there's this fabulous website called Google, I mean, it sounds so facetious, but you know, I'm in all the regular places, Instagram and Twitter and all that kind of thing, and I have a website, and you know, everything I do gets posted on there. I mean, so I'm actually working on a lot of different musical projects at the minute. I've got this new record that I'm working on. I've got two side projects on the go at the minute as well.
Oh, nice.
Just had the new book out, and there's this podcast coming with a new record. I wouldn't go so far as call it ADHD or anything, but like I definitely get bored easily,
right?
So I try and sort of keep myself you know, busy mentally doing stuff and creatively, I should say. So there's a lot of stuff coming up which I'm excited about.
Tremendous. Frank, good luck, and I hope to be at your show in Jersey on the 12th.
I'm very, very excited to be coming back to Asbury Park. So Asbury Park has become a verb in my touring circle.
It's awesome.
Which is to be Asbury'd means to be like, fucked up beyond compare, which goes back to this one time I was hanging out with Dave Haas in Asbury Park and like things went deeply, deeply south. Wherever we are in the world, if somebody's really messed up, we say that they've been Asbury'd.
Oh, nice. Well, Asbury has turned into just a really cool, really cool town now. Growing up, it was a town that like, you know, they always said, it's going to be nice one day. All we did was play, like, go to rock festivals and kind of fear for our lives. Like, I remember one time going to see Less Than Jake down there and had to park real far away, and this mob of, like, 10-year-old kids threw rocks at us all the way up the boardwalk. And we ran into the venue. But now it's, like, there's bars and music venues and everything you could possibly think of. So it's a really cool place to see a show, especially that Stone Pony summer stage is awesome. So, So I hope to see you there, and I want to thank you for giving me a few minutes here.
It's my pleasure, man. And if you're up in Asbury and we cross paths, say hi and we'll grab a beer.
Hey, guys, real quick, I want to tell you about something new we're associated with. If you like Verbal Shenanigans, the PodCoin app pays you to listen to this podcast and all other podcasts. It's the podcast player that pays. If you just get the PodCoin app on iPhone or Android, it's free. It's super easy to use. You can use the PodCoin app to claim gift cards or even donate to charity. It really is amazing. You can turn podcast listening into charity, or you could get something like Amazon or Starbucks gift cards. I now use the PodCoin app to do all my podcast listening now, and I love it. You can go get it on the App Store or on Android today. Seriously, just go to the PodCoin app and use your code, the invite code, Verbal Shenanigans. You'll get 300 PodCoins just for signing up if you use that code. That's 300 PodCoins just for signing up if you use the code Verbal Shenanigans. Go give the PodCoin app a try today. All right, back to the show. All right, that was Frank Turner, just a really down to earth guy. I mean, he's had a wealth of music experience, but he's also just like, I like him. Like I said in the interview, I like him because he's like very revealing in his song lyrics, very brutally honest, self deprecating, very much like a comic. Frank Turner. So Frank Turner's from England, Berlow.
Where's that?
England is this little state connected to New Mexico, which is why they call it New England.
Oh, cool, cool. I mean, is that part of the 55 states?
It is. It's the 54th, if I'm.
All right. Yeah. Western Alaska, that was 55. That's right.
But I say England because I don't know if I ever told this story either. That speaking of marriage, I know that Alex is wedding ready because I just went in the other room to take a pee right before we started this, and she is in my sweatshirt with a heating pad on her back with two packages of Girl Scout cookies, two different flavors, watching like I don't know if it's Desperate Housewives or what's this show with what's his name? The old Bears quarterback.
The old Bears quarterback.
The rich boy, the Vanderbilt kid.
Vanderbilt kid.
Whatever. Jay Cutler. Yeah. Him and his wife have like a reality show, and she's like in full.
I had no idea.
In full like wife mode, if you will, just vegging out as much as possible. But yeah,
the only football player I knew who had a TV show was Webster.
Well,
George Papadopoulos.
Now,
talking current events here on Verbal Shenanigans.
Yes. I did a semester in London. I don't know if I've ever delved into this. And if I did, it was probably 200-something episodes ago. So,
yeah, I would say that. So go on with your stories.
No, I wanted to tell. So I did a winter semester in London when I was in college. And it was London, like any city, like you're there for a while, kind of just feels like a city after a while. But I don't know if I ever told, I know I told this at one point, but Berlo, have you ever tried absinthe?
I have heard of it. I hear in its purest form, it can really F up a person if they're not ready for it, but yeah. I have not tried it.
Now, I heard the same thing. Like absinthe is going to make you you trip or get all crazy and blah, 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 blah. And like all these guys I was with, they wanted to try absinthe. And apparently it was like over the counter there. Like not over the counter, but in every liquor store over there. And apparently like, so we did find it. It was just like a green bottle. Kind of looked like Jägermeister, like the bottle.
Mm-hmm.
And so they wanted to try it, and apparently the way you do it is you take a sugar cube and you melt the sugar cube and put it in the shot and then take a shot of it or whatever, and it's like a green alcohol. It's you know, smells kind of like Jaegery too. Nothing happened. You know, you hear like, oh, you gotta get the old absinthe with the wormwood in it and stuff. Like, I don't know, everyone's got some story that they've heard from this guy and this guy and this guy. So once again, nothing happened, and we were going to go out. I remember this pretty clearly. The NFL playoffs were on in London at the time, and we were going to go out to this bar to watch the playoffs. And so we had the absinthe, a shot or two or whatever. I'm like, nothing's happening, you know. So we get to go down to the train station, and my buddies, they swipe their cards through the thing, and like when I'm there, the only outlet I have for cash is my ATM card, so it's pretty much the most important piece of item I have on me.
Yeah.
So my buddies go ahead of me. They're not even my buddies. I don't even know anybody on the trip. We just kind of became travel buddies or whatever.
You just pick three random guys and to drink absinthe with,
right?
Pretty much,
right? So I go to go put my card in to buy like kind of like Metro card, kind of. It's called the tube there.
Okay.
And my debit card gets stuck in the machine. So it's not coming out. I'm like, oh God. And I swear, I don't know if the anger or whatever happened. This is where the absinthe like hit me.
The blood started pumping. And it's like, oh, look what I found.
Right. So my friends had left and gotten on the train already. So there I am alone in the middle of London. It's pretty late, too, because you got to remember. So the playoffs might have been on 4 in the United States or whatever, or 5 o'clock. This was 11 or 12 o'clock, you know, in England. And there I am, like, freaking out, like, oh, I need my debit card. And, like, there's, like, a cop or an officer there, like, oh, I need to, all right, calm down. And I remember saying, like, if I don't get my debit card, I'm going to go nuts on a Brit. I'm going to kill a Brit. I'm going to go.
Okay, this sounds good. Continue.
Yeah. This probably, if it happened today, I would probably be behind bars or whatnot. But I'll never forget that they obviously knew I was drunk. And to be honest, it didn't feel any different than being drunk. Like, it wasn't like I was, like, hallucinating and seeing dragons or anything like that. It just felt like I had strong alcohol. Like, that's
okay.
It. I mean, eventually they did come, and they actually had, like, a pry bar, and they were opening up the ATM machine and stuff like that. And so I had gotten my card back eventually, and I never met up with my friends, and no idea where they went. And I had to take, like, I remember they warned us, like, back then, like, please don't take the unmarked cabs back. Like, they're not really from a service or whatever. What do? Call for a cab. It's an unmarked cab. Very weird guy, but I did get home, and that was my absinthe experience.
Yeah, I guess that's a European thing, because I remember in Bulgaria, like, there's regular taxi services and a dude who just painted his car yellow. Yep. And that's what it always is. And it's always the same thing when you go in there. He's like, oh, broken meter, 20 lev.
Yeah. Yeah, probably just trying to weasel as many American dollars as he can out of you. But now it's like they were kind of like the first Ubers, right? Like, you know, alternative cab company. And then another quick story from that trip. I decided to go to Ireland for 3 days on the weekend. We had time off or whatever. And, you know, like, going to Ireland there is like going and taking a trip to, like, I don't know, like Maine or something. Like, you know, it's a little 45-minute flight. And so we had went, and me, one guy, two guys and two girls went. And my one friend, he's like, as he gets off the plane, he's like, you know, like, he's breathing heavy, and during it, as we go throughout the day, like, he's getting worse and worse and worse. And he had, like, really bad asthma. And he's like, I don't know, dude. He's like, I've had this before. I got to go to the emergency room. I'm like, okay. So I think I'll take you. I'll take you to the emergency room. Now, the emergency room in Ireland, in the middle of Dublin, it was quite interesting. They have universal health care over there, or did at the time. I don't know if it still is. So what happens is a lot of homeless people just hang out in the emergency room, you know, because it's warm. Ah. There's seats, you know, there's people to talk to. There's water. There's a bathroom. So there I am, like, being approached by every homeless guy in Ireland just wanting to talk. And I think I had a New York Mets hat on at the time. So they're like, oh, yeah, I'm New York, how they were there. And they're all a stereotype, I know, but they're all loaded, you know, like, out of their minds. So eventually we had to go into the emergency room, and the emergency room was just kind of a room. In the middle was a bunch of the machines, but around the outside was all the patients.
Okay.
And eventually he had to get, like, a nebulizer, and, like, even then, inside, people getting taken. And, like, what would happen was, like, the homeless guys would just be like, oh, I have a, you know, whatever, like, my lungs are hurting. So they would basically buy their time, like, oh, you know, to go get checked out and, you know, spend 4 or 5 hours in the emergency room instead of out on the street. So that was kind of interesting, too.
Yeah, it's a cheaper hostel. I like it.
Yeah. And then my final story, which is, I guess, in my old bachelor days. Now, I was never good at hitting on girls, but there was the one counselor. He was, like, in charge of us. Like, you know, like, he was kind of in charge of our floor and keeping us, you know, telling us where things were on the college and whatnot. And he had this, like, girl with him. She was, like, visiting him from Arizona or whatever. And, like, long story short, like, he was definitely, like, trying to, like, hook up with her the whole time. And sure enough, like, she somehow fell for me in the middle of the stairwell on the way back from bar, and, like, you know, we're making out, if you will, and sure enough, who walks up the stairwell? That guy.
Would it be said person in love with said girl, Scott?
Yeah. Didn't say a word, walked right past us, but the next couple days were surely awkward. He didn't say a word to me the rest of the trip, but I didn't do anything. She came on to me.
I kind of had the opposite story, you know. I had your friend's outlook and all. When I was in Bulgaria and all, we got like super, super hammered, and I was trying to hit on this girl that I like, and she wasn't having anything to do with me, and she was going in with one of the other guys from work, and I was like super plastered. And I remember I go into my hotel room, and I was like, it's not fair, it's bullshit, and all. I was trying to get with her, it's not fair, bullshit. I didn't realize I was so drunk, I didn't close the door, and he's like on the phone with like one of my other buddies going, dude, he's plastered, I don't know what to do. He's like laying on the floor and screaming stuff.
He's just yelling.
Hence they called me Smooth Berlew after that.
They called you MB Smooth. But yeah, that was my time in England. England was a good time, though, I gotta say. England was a cool time. I'm hoping to go back next year. I want to go see my my favorite soccer team, Liverpool. That is one of the goals. Hopefully next year around this time, we would like to go and maybe check out the stadium, but who knows what next year will bring. But that's one of my bucket list kind of things to do. So,
Yeah, Europeans it just seems so like laid back there. I mean, about the only place I hear horror stories is like France and all. They're kind of dicks to Americans and stuff like that. But for the most part, they're all good. And you know, I've been to Bulgaria and had a small time in Turkey. That was all right. So they're good people.
Yeah. I enjoyed my time over there. What do you got, brother?
Yeah. Well, since you talked about Liverpool, let's call this a segue into another little game here. Scott, I'm so saddened as by the time this comes out, this would be coming out around the time week 10 of the AAF would be going on, where we'd be trying to figure out who was advancing in the Western Conference. Would it have been the Salt Lake Stallions? Would it have been the San Diego Fleet? I mean, there were so many teams in there. My poor Atlanta Legends got eliminated from the playoffs. But
now, Berlo, these guys could play in the A7FL.
And you never know. I mean, I'll call up Cesar and be like, listen, these boys need a home. They need a paycheck, and they don't need padding.
That is a reference.
That's what they do.
Reference to an interview that we did a long time ago. You don't have to go back to that one. Go check out Stu Cook.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But Scott, on that basis, looking back, there have been a ton of failed football leagues and sport leagues, and I'm going to give you a little playful game to go back to some of the yesteryear stories of these teams past and all. Are you ready, Scott?
Yeah, of course I'm ready. I am ready.
All right. A few of these will start off pretty simple with some of these questions. We'll get gradually more fun with these. So the Omaha Mammoths were in what league, Scott? Were they the United States Football League?
Oh, it's a quiz. All right, I'm in.
Were they United Football League? Were they the Fall Experimental Football League? Or were they the team that the Mighty Ducks beat in the World Hockey Tournament in Mighty Ducks 2?
I don't think it's them, because I thought they beat Iceland. So I'm going to go with C.
The Fall Experimental Football League. Scott, one for one. Good job.
Yes. And I can't even cheat on this one.
Yeah. So how about the Baltimore Stallions?
That's what they used to call me when I would go to Maryland.
Absolutely. Were they a former Canadian Football League team? Were they a USFL team? You kind of brought up, were they an A7FL team? Or was that actually an adult movie from 1989?
I hope it's D, but I don't think it's D. I'm going to go with B, Berlo. I'm going to go with B.
USFL team? Sorry. Baltimore had my love Philadelphia, then Baltimore Stars. No, Scotty, this is when the CFL tried to come into America and play their game down here and lasted about a year. Yeah.
Remember when... Remember when Pogs were so big? Remember Pogs?
Mm-hmm.
I remember when I was in fifth grade, I won a Pog tournament. Listen, ladies. Listen, ladies, I'm getting married. I'm off the market.
But Alex saw what was there. She moved fast, and she's getting it.
Oh, my big Pog champion. I love you.
you're my hero.
For those of you who don't know what Pogs were, for our younger listeners, Pogs were this stupid game that originated from Hawaii called Milk Caps. And you stacked the Pogs up, and the Pogs were all different designs. So you could have sports Pogs, you could have movie Pogs, TV show Pogs, and you're supposed to slam them, and however you flipped over, you won, whatever. But the point was, I remember in fifth grade winning this Pog tournament, winning a bunch of Pogs and like slammers and boards and stuff. And they were like, well, you have a real chance of entering the Pog, the professional Pog. I can't even say it because it's ridiculous. But like to be a professional Pog player, and they were saying something along the lines of like, oh, like we're starting, you know, we have a team entering and stuff like that. Like, would you be interested? And here I am, a fifth grade kid, seeing stars in my eyes. Like, yeah, you know, like maybe this is it. Maybe I am, like, maybe it's destiny to be a Pog player.
Did you have the conversation? Scott, we need you to do your history part. Mom, I'm going to be a world famous Pog champion. I ain't got time for history. I'm here to make it.
Mom, I'm a Pogger now. I don't need school.
I have to train 8 hours a day Pogging. Be out there outside, even if it's cold, even if it's raining, it's Pog time.
You know, Mom, don't disturb me. I'm topping on my Pog blog. Leave me alone.
Then there was the huge moment all where you're practicing and like your hand slips and you sprain your pinky. You're like, no!
Yeah. Or
my career!
Or it, if there was a Pog movie, like that climactic moment where we play like the Japanese team that's just unbelievably good at Pogs, and they just put us in our place and we got to train for like another 4 years.
Yeah, you got that really cocky Japanese kid coming up to you and you know Pogging, huh? Bam, 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 bam. What?
Yeah, right.
I never saw Pog moves like that.
Right. There's videos of him. There's scouting videos of him. Like, oh, Asuro Nakamura, the best Pog. Like, he's just like blasting Pog. Every single Pog is falling over his way. He's got slammers that are like in gold cases. We can make a movie out of this.
Yeah, let's call up Natty Bumper Car. He can draw up the poster for this thing.
Correct. Okay. But anyway, guys, I know, like you, we've interviewed a lot of cool people, but now you know that I am also a professional Pogger.
Yeah, you're the eye of the tiger, Scotty. But let's get back to our game here.
Okay.
Scotty, this team's owner had a player show up to his house and demand his paycheck or he would break his neck. What team was it? Was it the San Antonio Gunslingers, the Raleigh Durham Skyhawks, the Sacramento Mountain Lions, or the Miami Manatees?
God, I hope it's the Miami Manatees. I'm going to go with A.
The San Antonio Gunslingers. Correct.
Yeah.
It was part of the 30 for 30 where the owner was low on funds, so all their checks would bounce. So they said, 1 week, like every other Tuesday, they'd be like, we have your checks. You can only cash it at this bank. The bank would be 2 hours away. And basically, when practice ended, every single player would get into their car, and they were racing each other to get to the bank because they knew only about 20 of them would cash.
Now, more importantly, are the Miami Manatees an actual team in anything?
They were a potential team. Let me get my notes here. I was in one of it. They were a potential team for a league, and the league folded before they became of being. Damn. Here. Let me see here.
So you're saying I can't get Miami Manatee merchandise?
The Canadian Football League. Oh. They basically wanted to come back the next year, but they were doing so poorly in America that they folded all the American teams.
So I just typed in Miami Manatees merch. Apparently there is gear.
Oh, nice.
Manatees football. Wait, this has to be a... This might be a modern team somewhere, because these are, like, nice shirts. These are nice, man.
Honey, we're no longer going to see Liverpool.
Wow.
I got a new team.
Dude, I'll send you this link. There's some nice, sleek sweatshirts on here. I might just get one just to see people's reaction. Like, oh, you're a big Manatee fan? Oh, yeah. I've been following them since day one, you know.
But, Scott, which one of these was not a nickname for a former team in Las Vegas? The Posse, the Outlaws, the Strip, or the Locomotives?
The Strip.
Correct.
Yes!
The Posse was, again, our friends, the Canadian Football League. The Outlaws were the XFL. The Locomotives were the UFL.
The Strip. We're the Strip.
You ain't going to win when you come down the Strip.
All right. What else you got for me? Pretty good at this one.
You're not bad. Not bad.
The one we did a few weeks ago where I had to pick different endings from the podcast, that was tough, man.
Yeah.
It's funny that remembering our own stuff is harder than guessing other people's crap.
Exactly, because nobody remembers our stuff. Mm-mm. The Miami Sharks were a former World Football League team. Yeah, that was their theme song.
Oh, good.
Were they a former Arena Football League team? Were they the original name of the Miami Dolphins? Or were they Jamie Foxx's team in Any Given Sunday?
Miami Sharks, Jamie Foxx, huh? I feel like it sounds familiar. What were the options? Read the options back one more time.
A former World Football League team, a former Arena Football League team, the Miami Dolphins' original name, or Jamie Foxx's team in Any Given Sunday?
I think it's Any Given Sunday because I remember them like being down like in the beach or whatever. I don't know if it was the Sharks, though, but I do remember. I thought it took place kind of in Miami, Florida-ish region, so I'm going to go with D.
Correct, Scotty.
No, what? Really?
Yeah.
You know what I remember from that movie the most? My name is Willie. Beaming all the ladies. Called creaming. My name is Willie.
That's a very underrated movie.
Well, I mean, that song is very underrated is what you're saying.
Yeah. Which of these teams only played four games?
Best football movie. Best football movie. What do you got?
Best football movie.
There's a lot to choose from.
Any Given Sunday is up there for me. No.
Do I remember the Titans? Ooh. Ha. Ooh. Ha. I just do that around the house. But
I mean, I can't.
The program.
One that sticks in my mind was that nobody remembers was the Best of Times, where Robin Williams and Kurt Russell played. They were like a minor league football team, and like 20 years after they lost, they were like replaying this team, and they were just getting the living crap kicked out of them.
It's not a memorable one, but
it just always stuck in my mind for some reason. And like Robin Williams caught the big pass at the end, and he framed the other team by like coming in their mascot uniform and like spraying all the girls with spray paint to get all the guys to play that one last game.
I got to go. I know it's a dud answer, but for me, at least in my Rudy was my favorite growing up. For Rudy. Mm. Rudy was mine, so.
All right. Which of these teams only played four games and was established through mafia money? Was it Detroit Wheels of the WFL, the Akron Vulcans of the Continental Football League, the Pittsburgh Maulers of the USFL or the Brooklyn Bolts of the FXFL?
No, my brain goes right to Brooklyn because of mob money. So Akron, I can't picture the mob really getting tied in an Akron team, but I know Pittsburgh's pretty shiesty. I know I'm supposed to go with my gut, but I'm going to go with Pittsburgh.
It was Akron, Scott.
Really? Wow.
The team was based in Akron, Ohio, played four games, had a 1-3 record, and basically the owner swindled the entire city out of money and left.
Nice. Nice. Let me guess.
That's why you don't wear your Vulcan merchandise when you go to Ohio for your honeymoon.
I didn't tell you where we were going. How'd you know that?
Scott, I just saw the twinkle in your eye. I'm like, that boy's going to Akron.
That's the Ohio twinkle, they call it. The old,
that's the Akron smile I'm staring at. Baby.
The old Ohio twinkle.
In 1984, the Arizona Wranglers and the Chicago Blitz did what? Did they play a game in a Little League field after Arizona was kicked out of stadium for missing rent? Did they play with a combined 30 players?
I hope it's A. Go ahead.
Did they play with a combined 30 players due to a stomach flu epidemic on both sides? Did they make a trade to send all of their players for all the other players when an owner was sick of flying to home games? Or did they get into a fist fight after the game that required tear gas and a SWAT team to break up the affair?
Huh. Now, a lot of them sound they could be answers, but C sounded really specific to me and almost very unbelievable. So I'm just going to go with C, where they traded players just because the owner wouldn't want to.
You are correct.
Yeah.
Basically, the Chicago Blitz owner didn't feel like flying from Arizona all the time. They just traded all the players. And the funniest thing was they hired a coach before they did the trade. So this, like 30-year veteran came in there. He's like, wait a minute, this ain't the team I just signed up for.
That's funny. That's funny.
And then the team folded after that.
So, shocking.
Yep. Let's see. Pick out the fake name of these four, Scotty.
Is the XFL happening? Like, what's
next year?
Next year, okay. Are the original teams coming back or no?
Not the original teams. They've listed different cities. They got 8 cities. I know New York is coming back. We don't have a name yet. I think LA got a team. Seattle got a team. DC got a team. Tampa got a team. I forget the other 3 that were involved.
Yeah. All right. Well, they'll be on the next edition of this game.
Yeah. All right, Scott, pick out which one of these is a fake name. The San Antonio Texans 2. The Hamburg Sea Devils. The North Dallas Bulls or the Florida Black Tips.
I feel like you are misdirecting me because the something two might be real. So I'm going to go with I'm going to go complete reverse logic because the Black Tips doesn't sound like a bad name, like that bad anyway. So I'm going to go with the Black Tips.
It was the North Dallas Bulls. That came from a movie.
Damn.
Apparently there was already a San Antonio Texans. So when the CFL went down there, they said, we'll just call them two.
Like a sequel.
Pretty much. Let's see, 2 more. The Los Angeles Cougars had a championship game where they battled who, Scotty? The Arizona Hotshots, the Denver Gold, the Sacramento Surge, or the Incredible Hulk?
Please, God, be D. Please, God. I'm just going D because I want to know. I hope that's true.
It was an episode of The Incredible Hulk where they pissed off Bill Bixby and he just beat the living crap out of the entire football team.
Yes. Yes. Now I want to watch that.
So I think you got enough to win, but as our final, which is usually our tiebreaker question, I'll give it to you. Here are the 4 leagues in order of least amount of time playing to the most time. Tell me which order it came in. So the FXFL?
Am I going
so
from
basically,
least?
I'm giving you four names. Okay. You tell me, okay, this one was around the shortest amount of time, then the second shortest, and the third shortest.
All right, so I'm going least to greatest.
Then the longest.
All right.
Yeah. The FXFL, the USFL, the AAF, and the XFL.
Okay, hold on. I got to write these down.
All right.
Otherwise, I'm never going to remember these. All right, I'll just do it on my phone. Okay, so what was the first one?
The FXFL, the Fall Experimental Football League.
Who calls it the Experimental? Fall Experimental Football League. Okay.
Number two is the USFL.
USFL, okay, I know that one. Okay.
Number three is the AAF.
AAF.
And number four is the XFL.
Okay. So least I'm going to go with FXFL.
Okay.
Then I go with the AAF. Then I'm going to go with the XFL and then the USFL. So that is my final answer.
Okay. The league that went the least is the AAF. Going eight games, not a full season.
So the Fall Experimental League went longer than the AAF.
The second least is the XFL.
Oh, Jesus.
They lasted one season.
Yep, one season. Yep.
The FXFL was around for two seasons somehow. And then finally, our buddies at the USFL went three strong. So, Scotty, congratulations. It seems like you know your defunct football teams. I hope you get that jacket from the Miami Manatees and live up life.
I don't know any knowledge of this. I'm a very lucky guesser, but I'll take the win. Generally, I would like to know my record on all these all these games. I would say I'm probably hitting around 500.
Somewhere in that range, yeah. I would say.
I'm definitely not above the curve, but somewhere around 500. Berlo, you got anything else, or is it time to get the hell out of here?
Let's skedaddle there, Scotty, I guess.
All right, let's rock and roll. Berlo, anything to promote?
I'm going to promote us on Podcoin. Podcoin is the app out there that will actually pay you to listen to podcasts. If you join Podcoin, the app itself, or on their site, podcoin.com, and put in the promo code Shenanigans, you'll get 300 extra coins towards buying different gift cards or giving to charity. That's Podcoin, people. Enjoy your podcast and get paid at the same time.
I mean, listen, like, basically, you should. I mean, the only way you're going to get through our podcast is to get paid, so you might as well use the app.
And I will mention for the next 2 weeks, we are a featured podcast, so that means you get double points by listening to our show.
That's correct. And they're two good episodes too. Like the last couple of weeks we had some good episodes, so you're not getting
our whole catalog is available on Podcoin.
Well, yeah. So pick whatever the hell you want to listen to, just not the Zap episode. Listen to Elf. No, just not Zap. I'm going to promote Lucy Spraggan. Lucy Spraggan was one of our favorite guests from last year and an unexpected favorite guest. She's just a lot of energy, a lot of life, fun, quirky music. She's got a new album coming out, and she just released a song about 3 weeks ago called Lucky Stars. She's got a new album come out. If you guys like kind of pop, folky kind of music, and just like, she's a really interesting person and one of our favorite episodes. Definitely our most unexpected episode where we really enjoyed it. Like, we talked about working in caves and her adopting children, fostering, like just a really neat person. So go check out her new album, Today Was a Good Day, is coming out on the 3rd of May. And you can pre-order now to get Lucky Stars and Stick the Kettle On as an instant download. So go check her out. And then the Verbal Shenanigans comedy show, it was sold out before we even put flyers out. So
wow.
Yes. So it's growing and growing and growing. So the last Thursday of every month at Tap House 15. This month is awesome. Maybe you can call if someone drops out or cancels. Kevin Israel is headlining with a bunch of other funny comics, and I'll be hosting that night. So check that out. I guess that's it, Berlew. Life is funny. Well, first off, I want to thank Frank Turner. Life's not funny yet. Life is not funny yet.
No.
I want to thank Frank Turner for giving us the time. I want to tell you to go to go check us out. Go support comingrightup.org. Go support Discovery County Network. Go support the place we are in Pittsburgh that I can't.
WHBJ-DB.
Yeah. A lot of initials there. A lot of initials. But go check us out and support them. Support all the other podcasts that we like to work with, and the BS Podcast Network. And with that, guys, life is funny. Laugh at it. Keep the wind at your back. Bye-bye. And all the things I thought were true when I was young and you were too turned out to be broken. And I don't know what comes next. In a world that has decided that it's going to lose its mind, be more kind, my friends. Try to be more kind.